Hello and welcome to Fueling Around with me, Jason Plato, and the man who I often wish I could fire off into orbit. It's Dave Vitti.
Hello.
Fueling Around is powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Now then, Dave, big morning. How are you?
It is a very, very big day for us today. You know, so much so, Jason, that we haven't even got time for our normal, you know, daily chitter-chat.
Blather.
Because we're on a tight schedule, right? T-minus 30.
Yes.
We need to prepare for launch because we have got limited time with today's guest.
Mate, you're firing on all 10, aren't you, today? So our guest today is a gentleman who, well, we've been trying to get him on the podcast for what seems like light years. Mm. Essentially because we've just got loads of questions for the man. He's an author. And wait for this. He's an astronaut.
A real astronaut.
A real astronaut, which means, in my book, he's a real spaceman. It is, of course, the one and only Major Tim Peake. Tim, how are you?
Good morning. I'm really well. Yeah, good to see you both.
Hey, mate, I've just got this story, which I've got to get off my chest, because I've told everyone about this, and everyone's raised an eye going, oh, yeah, really, JP. Well, we first met at Silverstone, the British Grand Prix, about 4 or 5 years ago, up in a hospitality towards the end of the day, after the Grand Prix, at a major drinks brand. And I was having a chat with Tim, and obviously, you know, bombarded him with questions. And then guess what happened next? A chap came up to have a chat with Tim. And what do you think he did, Dave?
I don't know. Was he a publicist, or was he an agent?
No, he was another astronaut. Right, so that's two astronauts. He was an American chap. Do you remember this, Tim?
Yeah, that was Drew Feustel. Yeah, a good friend of mine.
Unbelievable. No, I've told so many people about that, and they all raise an eyebrow and go, oh, yeah, all right then, JP. Please confirm that.
Yeah, no, Drew was in between missions, and we knew each other from training over in Houston. He's a lovely bloke, and he was actually getting ready for his second mission, and he's a huge Formula One fan.
Yeah, yeah.
And had some friends who worked at that major drinks company that you mentioned. And so we'd been touring around the factory, we'd been driving the simulator and enjoying a day at Silverstone.
Wow. Amazing.
I love that. As I say, thank you so much for joining us today, Tim. Genuinely, so many questions to ask you. A lot of those are about the book, and then about space, and then more stuff about the book, etc. So let's get into the book first and foremost. It's entitled Space, A Human Story. My question for you is, do you think that this will answer most of Jason's extensive list of remedial questions, and therefore, should I perhaps buy him for Christmas?
Oh, nice.
I certainly hope it will give a flavour of the kind of inside story of some of the things that go on in the space industry. Mm. It is that human element, isn't it? It's about what we've been doing since the early days of the space race, right up until, you know, my friends and colleagues who are right now training to go back to the moon. It kind of covers all of that. But we just didn't have enough room to put in every story of the 628 people who have flown to space. But I think I've got a flavour of the best ones.
My Lord, only 628. That's incredible. Incredible number. So look, here's a question. I'm off and running now. So the no gravity thing, how does that work? I mean, have you got to be strapped down all the time, or anchored up, or do you just float around?
Most of the time you float around when you want to. If you want to do any tasks with your hands, the problem is that you need to anchor your feet before you can work with your hands, and you can't be holding on to things all the time. So we are constantly using our feet kind of underneath handrails. We're gripping with our feet, if you like, like monkeys. And what's really strange is after 6 months in space, the soles of your feet are completely clean and fresh, like baby's feet. You just don't put any weight or pressure on them. But the top of your feet are horrible and scaly and hard skin, because you're constantly sliding your feet underneath these handrails to stabilise your body position. So, yeah, we have to always find a stable position before you can use your hands.
So if you were just floating and you pushed into the air, would you get a reaction to go backwards? Is it...
That's interesting. Yeah, you can. It's you can actually kind of spin yourself around just by using your body, the momentum of your body, with rapid movements of your arms or legs and kicking. It's a bit like kind of swimming in space, swimming in weightlessness. Right. You only ever really need to do that if you get completely stuck in the middle of a module, and you can either shout for somebody to come and rescue you, or you can start swimming around and moving your body until you can reach a handrail and get yourself back. That's why with spacecraft we don't actually want them to be too big, there's no point. You could just get stuck. You always want to be able to reach out and grab a handrail.
So when you talk about these rails, presumably I'm imagining underneath your desk or wherever you're sat, a little bit like, you know, in pubs, with the way that they would used to have the rail that you could put your feet on. Do you remember? You used to have a sort of rail there. I guess you've got one of those that you just sort of tuck your toes into.
Absolutely, yeah. There's rails everywhere. Yeah. You're always kind of tucking your feet under. Yeah. And outside on a spacewalk, we have foot plates so that we can actually put our spacesuit boots into these foot plates and anchor ourselves there. Uh-huh. And then you can be driven around on the end of a robotic arm, for example. I mean, that's the most crazy thing, is when your crewmate inside is driving you around on a robotic arm and you're in this foot plate out on the space station. You have to have a lot of faith that then not going to bang you into something.
How funny. By the way, for those that are watching the video version of this, it does look a little bit like we are talking to you from space, but actually you are in a sort of BBC broom cupboard, talking to us now. And we know that because just before, this links into my next question, is that one of your assistants brought you a coffee halfway through. So for those that thought you were in deep space, suddenly this sort of Costa coffee arrived. But I wanted to continue the food and drink theme. Again, you know, it's all these basic things that, it sounds childish, I grant you, but these are all the things that ordinary people like us think about. It's like, where do you go to the toilet? What do you eat? I mean, what do you eat in space? Do they have microwaves? How is stuff heated up? How does it work?
Yeah, we don't have a microwave. We have an electric food warmer, which is a bit like, a toaster. And you can kind of put these foil pouches in, which is just like camping food, stuff that's irradiated and then comes up. So, if you're going to fly food to space...
Like army rations, I guess, as well.
It's just like army rations, It's got to have a long shelf life. It's got to be lightweight packaging. It's got to be robust to withstand the G-forces of launch. All that kind of minimal packaging, all these things. But it's then also got to have the minerals and nutrients and vitamins that you need and the calories. Mm. And probably the last thing they think about is the taste. That's perhaps a bit unfair. What they do is they actually lower the salt content, because salt exacerbates our bone density loss. So their food ends up being a little bit bland and a little bit tasteless occasionally. So it's getting better, but it's not the best.
Yeah, well, I've heard that the higher you go, the more salt you need to make the taste. Because apparently on Concorde, their dishes, when God bless it, when he's flying around, were loaded with salt just to balance it up.
Oh, really?
Apparently. Yeah, so.
It's interesting, different environments. And what was interesting with, like, Concorde and airliners, they tend to operate at lower pressure, maybe about the same pressure you could get about 7,000 feet, perhaps. And in space, we actually operate at one atmosphere. So it's exactly the same pressure as we have now. But you're right about the smell, because no air's rising. We don't get convection because you've not got any gravity. There's no difference in hot air versus cold air in terms of rising and falling. So this, without this convective heating, you know, here on Earth, you get a nice hot plate of food and all that smell is coming up your nose. And that gives you so much of your taste. And we don't get that in space at all.
I could speak all day about space questions, but obviously you're into speed, you're into power, kind of in an intergalactic way. Mm. But when you're on Earth, you know, what's your car passion? What drives that? Bikes, cars, what is it?
My cars, I'm afraid they're pretty boring and practical. So I get my fun from bikes. I like off-road biking, actually. But I've been riding quite a few Triumph motorbikes recently. And anything from the Street Triple, which is just a crazy bike, but a lot of fun, through to the big sort of Tiger 1200s, which I love. I do enjoy driving as well. I've had a couple of track days down at Goodwood, which is very close to where I live, and you know, being able to jump in and out of these supercars, it's such a privilege to be able to do that. And I remember taking the McLaren 720 round the track, And the instructor I was with said, you know, there's only one corner I'm going to ask you to lift slightly. Otherwise, it's either full throttle or full brake. And he said, when I say full brake, I mean full body weight on the brake. You know, you stamp. And it was just blistering. I mean, we were going some crazy speed down the back straight, and this 90-degree corner is coming up, and I was thinking, can we brake now? Can we brake now? He's like, hold it, hold it. So, I do like speed. I do like cars and bikes.
Does that ring true then for you, Jason, in terms of Goodwood? Can you do... Is it a track of extremes with full on and full off?
Yeah, do you know what? There's some... I mean, that, you know, you're talking about the 720S. I mean, by any shadow of any imagination, that is a rocket ship, that car. Yeah. But in anything, I mean, I've raced around there lots in old classics. You know, there's a mixture of corners there. Some slow, tricky stuff, but by God, it's some fast corners. Yeah. But it's old school. There's no runoff. There's no gravel traps. You go off, you're going to hit something very hard. So it's a great circuit, and I'm sure... I mean, you know, that instructor who sat next to you, he's a braver man than I would ever be.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I know. Hats off. I actually took the M5 off the track on the one of the corners. I can't remember the name of the corner, but it was one of the corners, about the only corner you can just get away with it, and we got back on the track. But that was a nightmare. I thought, am I just about to write off an M5 now? I just got out the M3, and I didn't really fully appreciate the extra weight as we were going into the corner and left the braking a bit fast. But I take my hat off to those instructors, because they just get you to push you to the absolute limit. And it's your limit, of course. It's not the car's limit. The car can do so much. It's your personal limit.
I couldn't do it. I mean, I used to do it long, long time ago, like 30 years ago. I used to instruct. I just haven't got the bottle for it now. I just can't. I can't sit next to people. Even professional drivers. I hate it. Do you know what I mean?
I think that's an age thing, though, isn't it? Don't you just become more intolerant as you get older?
Well, to anything, actually. I mean, I was shouting at myself in the mirror this morning.
As a flying instructor, I used to love taking up new pilots. But it's the same thing. It's kind of that you're almost challenging yourself as to when, how late you can leave it before you do need to just jump on the controls and stop the aircraft from crashing. And I'm not sure I'd have the same amount of patience and tolerance today as I did back then.
No, I don't think my nerves could handle it, to be honest with you. Not that I'm equipped to actually instruct on either, but I don't think that mentally I'm the right person. Tim, let's go back to the early days, if we can. Passing your test is obviously a huge rite of passage, we always say. It's a huge part of everybody's life. Certainly for me, it was the thing that I wanted to do more than anything else, far more important than anything I did or didn't do at school. Can you remember passing your test? And indeed, what was your first car?
Oh, I completely remember passing my test, yes. I was thankfully passed it first time. And I did love driving. I loved the technical side of it. I loved understanding how an engine worked, gearbox and clutch and all the rest of it, and those first experiences of driving. And then I went and got myself a Mini Clubman Estate. I think it was about 350 quid, but it was beige with the wooden strip down the side.
I tell you what, it'd be worth a lot more than 350 quid now.
Yes, it wouldn't be just.
And the two barn doors opening at the back. Yeah. And I was working in a pub. I was a barman at the time. And I remember one day my boss, we ran out of Guinness, and he said, you've got to go to the brewery and pick up a couple of barrels of Guinness. So I drove there, and I loaded two barrels of Guinness into the back of the Clubman, and that was the end of the suspension. I mean, it just wrecked the car. I had to sit on a cushion after that, because I couldn't afford to repair the car. So I just sat on a cushion because the suspension was absolutely trashed.
The hearing aid beige Mini bit the dust. Yeah. Hey, so what came after the Mini?
After the Mini, I had a Fiat, which my grandma gave to me. Mm-hmm. That's when I was at Sandhurst. And I was doing some long trips because my sister was up at Keele University. And so at the weekend, I'd go and see her, and we'd go to these university parties. So I'd bring kind of my Sandhurst mates with me, and we'd go to student union parties and then drive back. So ended up doing a lot of mileage in that little Fiat. After that, I was posted off to Northern Ireland with the Royal Green Jackets. And that's when I got my first car that I fell in love with. And that was a BMW 320 Motorsport. Nice. Absolutely love that car.
A drifting Supremo round roundabouts.
Oh,
if I recall.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I ended up going backwards on the M27 in that, and ended up in the central reservation.
No way.
But I was a young pilot in training, and the tyres should probably have been replaced about 6 months earlier than they were. They were a little bit flat and aquaplaned at night one time driving back. And thankfully there was no other traffic on the road, but that gave me a real shock. That was the first time I'd actually kind of been in a car accident. And I think when you're young and fearless, you think that you're absolutely invincible, and something like that kind of wakes you up to reality.
I'm not sure that's just for young people, though.
It's also weird, the fact that I find that in any kind of situation like that, you know, I've been lucky. I've not had any major crashes in my time, but I have had a couple. It all happens in slow motion, I always think.
Yeah.
Don't you think it's weird? When you look back to something, the whole process, which must have been fractions of a second, just seemed to have been a bit like, you know, almost like a film. It's a bit like, whoa, we're going to hit him any time now. It's very, very strange.
But I think that actually gives you extra time to make your decision. I remember I kind of span a couple of times. I remember seeing that bridge twice through the windshield as a spinning around, and then having the kind of presence of mind as you're going backwards to really think about how to move over to the centre of reservation while still going quite fast, and actually use it to slow down and get out the way of any traffic coming. And again, it happened in a fraction of a second, really. But I think that whole thing just allows your brain to operate in a heightened sense of awareness.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, that's what racing cars is like. I can imagine, because it's, you know, you're in the moment, but I imagine if someone was sat next to you, everything would be going at a million miles an hour, but somehow you just slow it all down. And very occasionally you do feel that happen, and you have all the time in the world, say on the brakes at 150 mile an hour to go down 4 or 5 gears, but it doesn't happen all the time. It would be lush if it did. I'm sure it does for Lewis Hamilton and Max Verstappen. I'm sure they're going at a very slow pace in their heads.
Yeah.
Tim, you were saying before about obviously you get your thrills from your bikes, and that your day-to-day drive is fairly family orientated and not that exciting. Is there a motoring itch that you would one day like to scratch? Is there something in there you think, do you know what, one of these days, that's the thing for me?
Oh dear. I mean, I'd love to take the old Aston, you know, DB5 out round the track, something like that. I haven't actually driven any classic sports cars properly, so I think that for me would, you know, be fantastic fun, because it's so much raw. I've, in fact, just this week the Gazelle helicopter went out of service with the British Army, and I flew that aircraft for many years, over 1,000 hours, and it's just like, you know, it's like the E-type of the sports car world. Yeah. You've got this low seated position with your legs out in front of you, a slight smell of engine oil in the cockpit, and everything's really raw. There is no autopilot, no stability control system or anything. It's just you and the stick and the elements, and I think that's probably what you get from a classic car.
Yeah, it's a fantastic looking helicopter, that, isn't it, with the exposed engine on the back. It's a proper thing, isn't it?
It is a proper aircraft, yeah, and it's properly fun to fly as well. I mean, it belies its manoeuvrability, actually. It's really a very agile, fast helicopter, and you can do, you know, loops and rolls in that thing. It's manoeuvrable.
Can you really?
Absolutely, yeah. But it'll, like an old car as well, it'll bite you if you get it wrong.
Well, we talking of old cars, I can definitely get you in something which I drive a lot of, and it scares the living daylights out of me. So it'll be fine for you. It's an old big block Chevrolet Corvette Stingray.
Oh, wow.
Which I race at Goodwood. Yeah. So off air, we'll sort that out.
Sounds great. Brilliant. Yeah.
Oh, genuinely, I was just thinking that before, as you say, when you were talking about racing old stuff, and I kind of thought, well, I know what the way in for that, Jason. I mean, you should partner up, and actually, you two at Goodwood in something old and crazy, that could be fantastic.
That'd be
it?
A lot of fun. A lot of
fun. We'll sort that out. Hey, topic of conversation on our TVs all the time nowadays is electric vehicles. What's your thoughts on that? Fancy one? Would you? Have you?
I'm driving a Ford Mach-E at the moment.
Okay.
And really enjoying it. I mean, they are, they're really good. I think it tells you how much noise pollution we have in our lives, because they're just so much quieter. And obviously you get a much greater torque and you can have fun with that acceleration. I've been really pleasantly surprised as how much fun they are to drive. I think it is the way ahead. I think it is the future. So something we're all going to probably embrace at some point.
Absolutely. You know, as I say, it's something that we do, and we sort of feel we have to ask all of our guests, really, because it's such a big topic, isn't it, Jace? I mean, Christ, you know, you do a TV show all about electric vehicles, so you're the man at the cutting edge.
Funnily enough, we do. And you know what? I didn't like them at all. And you know why? Because I've never spent time with them. And once you actually, you know, get rid of the prejudice, because I come from a V8, V10, you know, noisy petrol world. Once you actually spend a bit of time with them, like the noise you mentioned, Tim, it's a completely different experience. And actually, it's pretty cool, isn't it?
Yeah. No, it is. It is really nice. And I think the technology's moved on now to the point where, you know, you're getting very good range out of these vehicles. We're getting more infrastructure for charging. It's less of that anxiety of, oh my God, when am I gonna run out and where can I recharge? And I think once we get over those kind of hurdles, and once, you know, the cost of the second-hand market starts bringing the cost of vehicles down, then it's going to be something that, you know, is going to be much more accessible to everybody.
I think so. I definitely think so. So here's, I'm just mindful that we are rapidly approaching the end when we need to let you go, Major Tim. A couple more questions from myself and JP. The first one is this, and this is quite a tricky one, I always think. Of all the cars you've ever owned in your time, you need to pick one and one only and stick with it for the rest of your life. Which one is it and why?
It would have to be the 320 Motorsport.
Oh,
because I ended up, after that accident, and thankfully it was just a bit of body work, I ended up having the engine overhauled. And it was just back to, in fact, it was better than it had ever been. I had this mechanic who was just absolutely passionate about rebuilding cars. And I was a young army pilot at the time, nothing else to spend my money on. So I thought, well, let's spend it on getting my engine rebuilt. and that car afterwards was just, it was a delight to drive. I just had so much fun in it. So, it had the beautiful alloy wheels, lower suspension. I mean, it was the bee's knees. It was brilliant. It was fantastic.
Hey, mate, don't call them accidents. It's just a shunt. It's a shunt.
A little shunt, yes.
Yeah, a wee little shunt, because that could conjure up anything in your mind, couldn't it? So, look, here's a great question for you. We always believe that music and cars go particularly well together. So, a fantasy drive. Where are you? Where are you going? What are you listening to? But most importantly, if you could pick any car in the world, what are you driving?
Oh, right. So I would be... when I lived in Houston, we used to love doing kind of big camping trips up to the northwest. It was like Wyoming, Montana, Utah, Idaho, all those lovely areas.
Yeah.
So I'd probably be driving along the Grand Teton, you know, that valley where the Grand Tetons are on the left-hand side, and you've just got these big open fields and bison roaming around. So I'd be blasting down that valley there. Listening to Guns N' Roses' Sweet Child of Mine. What would I be driving? Actually, on those roads, you'd probably want to be in some big pickup truck, because that's what you need to be driving in the States. So, yeah, I'd be in some big, massive Ford pickup truck or something.
With a V8 in, obviously, a big
big V8. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. We're not going for electric, are we, on the way to Wyoming or somewhere like that? We want a massive, great, big, growling V8. Tim, before we let you go, just quickly, news obviously this week. Did I read somewhere that you are coming out of retirement?
Well, we signed a memorandum of understanding. There's a company called Axiom Space, US company, that runs commercially sponsored missions. And the UK Space Agency is having conversations with them, looking at an all UK mission to space, which would be really exciting. So I am helping the UK Space Agency and Axiom with that mission. We haven't assigned a crew yet, and there are several steps before that mission becomes a reality. But we could be looking for, you know, a crew of four to go and fly to space. And if the opportunity comes comes along, then I'll make myself available.
I can drive most things. How hard can it be? Yeah, I know how to hook my legs under bar rails.
You don't even need to corner very well. It's just straight line speed.
Yeah, and I can throw my arms around to reorientate myself. I'm your mantis.
Jason, I think we have just volunteered, haven't we? I think for you and me in space, and I think on that note, you need to take us out or take us into orbit, maybe.
Well, let's go. Mm. Let's fire the rockets up. Well, unfortunately, that is it for this week's Fueling Around, powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your car, your bike, your home, or maybe even your rocket. Dave, absolutely. As always, a big thanks to you, but a huge thanks to our special guest this week, the one and only Major Tim Peake.
It's been great talking to you both. Thank you very much,
Tim. It's been great. Don't forget, the book is out now from all good retailers and even some of the bad ones, and is entitled Space: The Human Story. Perhaps buy it for a loved one in the season of goodwill, Jason. As always, you can get in touch with us on Twitter at Jason Plato, at David Vitti, and if you like what you've heard, feel free to give us a 5-star rating, press the follow button, and share the podcast on all your socials.
Thanks for listening, guys and girls, and well, we'll catch you next time round the other side of the moon.